Support for Pray Public is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org.
Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today is Juneteenth, a federal holiday in the United States commemorating the end of slavery. So we hope you enjoy this special edition of Main Street from the acclaimed No Small Endeavor podcast with its host, Lee C. Camp. This episode features three prominent Black voices on the issue of race. Fred Gray discusses working as Martin Luther King's lawyer during the Montgomery bus boycott. Willie James Jennings describes the religious and cultural origins of racism. And the late James Lawson, architect of the civil rights movement, explains how he and others came to believe that the only effective way to desegregate the nation was through nonviolent protests.
I'm Lee C. Camp. This is No Small Endeavor, exploring what it means to live a good life. The U.S. federal holiday of Juneteenth celebrates the day that the final enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation was ordered in Texas on June 19, 1865. It was the final official act of ending legalized chattel slavery in the U.S. What were the social, religious, philosophical commitments that made possible the rationalization of the horror of chattel slavery in the first place? Today, for example, we'll hear Yale professor Willie James Jennings contend that the presumably good and divinely ordained European missions accompanied colonization, which was also presumed to be good, which accompanied the creation of racialized stereotypes, which led to the rise of racial oppression. We'll also hear from two courageous moral exemplars who came to the conviction that their own pursuit of a good life required that they stand for justice and equity during the U.S. civil rights movement. One of these, Reverend James Lawson, is considered by many to be one of the architects of the nonviolence of the U.S. civil rights movement and truly one of the greats of his generation. Reverend Lawson just passed away at the age of 95 this past week. And we start today with Dr. Fred Gray, first attorney for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Miss Rosa Parks during the Montgomery bus boycott. Here's our conversation from one of our live shows.
Very privileged tonight to have Dr. Fred Gray, the author of Bus Ride to Justice, was the first attorney for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as well as Miss Rosa Parks during the famous Montgomery bus boycott. And as I've been reading back through his book this week, I realized how privileged I was to get to interview tonight one of the most important and influential lawyers in the civil rights movement in the United States. His case as a 24-year-old, if I remember correctly, 24-year-old attorney to desegregate Montgomery's bus system was upheld by the United States Supreme Court. 2 years later, he personally and successfully argued before the Supreme Court a case which overthrew gerrymandering in Tuskegee, Alabama, which established a highly acclaimed legal precedent with regard to voting rights. A list of successful cases much too long to talk about, including the infamous Tuskegee syphilis study. He served long and well, and we welcome you and grateful that you're here with us tonight. We grew up in the same state, but for you, because of the Dred Scott decision, you couldn't go to law school in Alabama. You went away to school, to Cleveland, came back, and you say repeatedly in your book that your desire after law school was to come back to Alabama and destroy everything segregated you could find. Was there a moment at which that kind of goal was solidified?
It was, and let me first say it's good to be back in Nashville. I went to high school here and then went back home. When I returned to Montgomery, and I was born in Montgomery in the middle of the Depression, but after finishing the Nashville Christian Institute here, I returned to Montgomery to go to Alabama State. In those days, there were two professions that African Americans could really feel good about. One was a preacher and one was a teacher. I decided to be both. So I had been to Nashville to learn how to preach up here. Then I went back home to learn at Alabama State how to become a teacher. I lived on the west side of town. Alabama State was on the east side of town. I worked for the local newspaper downtown, so I used the public transportation system from as little as twice a day to as much as eight times a day. I observed many of our people were being mistreated on buses, and one person had even been killed in an altercation. I also observed from a friend who had been president of the local NAACP that if an African American had a cause of action against a white person, I don't care how meritorious it was, there was very little likelihood that he would get any kind of justice. And I observed everything in Montgomery, and I'm talking about in the 40s, was completely segregated from having to go to segregated facilities and drinking various fountains that were all segregated, till I came up with the idea that we needed, in addition to preachers, we needed a lawyer. I made a secret commitment when I was a teenager, while a junior at Alabama State College for Negroes. I said I was going to finish college, go to law school, not even apply to the University of Alabama because I knew they wouldn't admit me. Finish, come back to Alabama, take the bar exam, pass it, become a lawyer, and destroy everything segregated I could find. That was the basic philosophy behind me. I saw a need and wanted to fulfill that need.
One of the most stories that just made me sit up straight, because I think so many people, even my generation, and certainly my children, just cannot understand or comprehend what things were like then. But you tell the story about how one day in court in Selma, I think it was, where you referred to a client or another attorney who was African-American with the title Mr., and you were rebuked by the judge.
Yes, I was representing a young man who was in the United States Air Force. And during the course of the trial, I was referring to my client as Mr. And the judge, and of course all of them in those days were white, told me, "You don't call him that here." And at first I really didn't understand what he was saying. Then I recognized he was objecting to my calling my client Mr. So I said, "Well, Your Honor, may I call him Sergeant Jones?" That was his name, Wesley Jones. He said, "That's fine. Sergeant Jones is fine." And if you look at the transcript of the records of any of those cases in these courts in Alabama during the 40s and the 50s, and maybe even in the 60s, it referred to the white lawyers as Mr. It referred to the black lawyers as attorney. So the matter of disrespect was one thing. And of course, most African Americans were born in those days without the assistance of a doctor and without being in a hospital. But when you did go to a hospital, it was segregated. You go to a doctor's office, it was segregated. The buses were segregated. The schools, the churches, every aspect of American life was completely segregated. And those of you who are much younger now don't realize it. But the humiliating effect of that was devastating. And the Supreme Court recognized it in the Brown decision when it held that segregation in public education was wrong because it inherently showed a reflected inferiority of blacks and not of whites.
You ate lunch with Rosa Parks the very day she was arrested. Is that correct?
That's correct. But not only did I eat lunch with her every day, I had known Mrs. Parks since the time I was in college. And she lived only three blocks from the Holt Street Church of Christ where I attended church. So we were friends and I knew her, and she was interested in me as a professional. And she worked a block and a half from my office. So we spent all of our lunches 5 days a week talking about conditions in Montgomery, including the buses and what one should do if something developed. And I was the last person who saw her that day before she was arrested on December 1st, 1955.
As you began to be involved in the movement, surely you received your own kind of harassment and threats and so forth. What were things that helped you keep on going and not quit?
And I think the thing that has helped me most and has been the key point in my career has been my religious faith. My mother and my father were both members of the church, and I grew up in the church. We believed to place the Lord first, and these other things would be added to us. That principle directed me not only during my high school years here and my college years and my law school years, but it also served throughout my whole life. In every case I handle, even today, I first look at it in terms of whether or not my handling this case would it in any way interfere with my faith in the Lord. And if it does, then I don't take it. If not, and I feel there's merit to it, I do my best. I would be the first to say that conditions in this nation has substantially changed since I started practicing law, and I'm happy to have been a part of that change. What we were concerned with at that time was destroying segregation that was required by the laws. A person would tell you, well, I do this or I do this because of your race. They will say that the law said we must be separated. So what we had to do was go into the courts and get all those laws declared unconstitutional, and we've done that. But as I look back after 57 years of practicing law, and while we have been able to move the law itself, you really have to look at what has really happened. Let's look at the results. If we see the same thing happening today that happened 50 or 60 years ago in the field of race relations, then we need to determine whether or not things really have changed. The disparity which exists between whites and blacks in health care, in economics, in employment, in life expectancy, I don't care what index you take, you will find that is a tremendous disparity. And in many instances, not in all, that disparity can be traced back to race. So I think if you want to really look at yourselves, and everybody now like to think of themselves as being fair and equal, and that you would like to have a level playing field, look in your homes, look in your schools, look in your churches, look in your fraternities and your sororities and your place of employment. And if everybody there looked like you racially, you may have a serious question of diversity. So I think until such time as we are able to remove these barriers which keep us from being able to obtain an equal opportunity to enjoy all of the blessings that this country gives us, then we're going to have problems and we need to work on getting them solved.
You mentioned in the book that you're proud of the fact that you were Dr. Martin Luther King's first attorney in the civil rights movement. What was it like in 1956 during the Montgomery bus boycott when his house was bombed?
Well, of course, I was with Dr. King at Ralph Abernathy's church at the time that the house was burned, and I immediately drove over right after him, and I watched the crowd and watched how he was able, once he found out that his wife Coretta and his children were well, and how he talked to the crowd, because it could have been a great deal of violence that night, but he was able to speak to the people, to tell them everybody it was all right, and to go home. And he was the kind of person that he could really convince people to do things by his words. On the other hand, he was a very practical person. If he were to come into a room, whatever you're doing, Martin Luther King Jr. would just join in it. If you were sitting on the floor, he would join there with you. If you were joking, he would joke. You would never know that he would be able to speak the way he spoke. And he had a sense of humor. He would even tell jokes, some of which he couldn't tell in the pulpit.
We are profoundly grateful for your work and profoundly grateful to have you with us tonight, and we thank you. Please thank Dr. Fred Gray.
Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate being here.
If you're just joining us, today is a special episode with two moral exemplars of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement and a unique look at the complicity of religion in racism.
When the colonists came to the New Worlds, the places we would now call Africa, Latin America, Pacific Islands, many other places, the United States, when they came to these places, they came understanding themselves to be there primarily by the providence of God.
That's Dr. Willie James Jennings, professor at Yale and author of the book, The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. He insists that imagination has far-reaching consequences.
Imagination is the womb within which reality comes to be.
He argues that the European Christian imagination entailed an ethic of progress mixed with a racialized view of the world that saw lighter skin as superior and darker as inferior. This imagination had further imagined and enacted consequences.
God had brought them to these places for two reasons. Reason number one, to cultivate these lands in the ways they should be cultivated, to take them and to steward them properly, to use the language of a Puritan. But the other was to convert the indigenous peoples, to mature them in the faith. And so the idea of maturing both land and maturing body was crucial to what they understood themselves to be about in the new world. And this was at the hand of God. This was, they are fully inside the providence of God. Now, as a part of coming to the new world, one of the things that we rarely think about, how overwhelmed and how overwhelming all of this was. Lee, you have to think about what it must have been like for anyone from the old world of Europe to come to any part of the new worlds in these centuries and to see the majestic Rocky Mountains or the Pacific Ocean or Virginia, what we now call Virginia, or the mountains of West Virginia, or Florida, or Peru, or Mexico, to see this incredible beauty and land beyond what anybody had imagined, and animals, the diversity of which was mind-boggling, and people, the diversity of which was mind-boggling, the diversity of their languages, mind-boggling, and the need to try to make sense of a world that was now unfolding in front of them, a world for which they really had not been prepared to comprehend in its fullness. A part of the work of comprehension involved trying to make sense, to bring into some kind of cognitive order what was in front of them. And part of that work, central to that work, was to try to categorize, to organize the kinds of bodies, the kinds of flesh, the kinds of animals that were in front of them. Now, obviously, in order to do that kind of organizing, anytime one organizes, one has to use oneself as an anchor of the organizational logic.
Speak from what is known
toward what is not known. That you have to use yourself as the anchor of the organizational logic. As it happened, the designation of peoples according to body type, according to skin color, according to all their physical characteristics, fell into an organizational schema that had white at one end and black at the other end. Now, the mistake so many people have made as they've looked back at this history, not so much historians, but people looking at what historians have done. Some historians have made this mistake. But this categorization was not simply about people of European descent being white, people of African descent being black. It was a form of categorization. It was a form of organization within which you could fit the entire planet on a scale from fully developed, mature white all the way to completely underdeveloped black. So
yeah, I was completely taken, surprised by the scheme that you've laid out in the book and the remarkable way in which everybody got categorized at some point along the
continuum. Everybody got categorized. And here's what you had to remember, the engine that drove this, what people often make a mistake. The engine that drives this is not the eternal coherence and logic of the organization itself. What drives it is a vision of providence that God has placed us here to organize. And that's what people mess up on. Why do they put these people? Why do they put the Asians near these people? Then put these particular Native Americans. You're going to hurt yourself. Trying to understand the organization because you're missing them. But the point is, the organization is being carried out, driven by two profound engines. On the one side, it's the belief in providence that God has sent us, i.e. these Europeans, here to organize, to make sense of this world. And then on the other side, the other engine that's driving it is the need to cope with the absolute, what I call the epistemological density of the new world that is opening before them. That is the womb within which race starts to form. The Europeans turned a deaf ear. They turned off their ears to the ways in which indigenous peoples understood themselves and defined themselves and talked about themselves. They talked about themselves always in relationship to the place and to the animals, to the landscape, and to the way of life that constituted their identity. That is, they didn't carry their identities on their bodies without remainder. To understand who they were, you had to understand the animals that they lived in communion with, the animals they ate, and the way in which, you know, as the great Native American theologian Ting Tinger says, the way they lived in balance or sought to try to live in balance and reciprocity, and the way in which the land itself was imagined as coexisting with their ancestors. All of that was their identity. But for the European, no, this was land to be taken and cultivated, i.e. made private property. Who you are is what you wear on your body. And so the break is there, the break between identity tied to land with the very body, that break, so that racial identity and private property form together in the new world. So it's these powerful currents flowing together that start to create the racial imagination.
As a Christian white man raised in the South, who for a long time has been seeking to disentangle myself from various forms of racism and the like, I think in my uninformed ways of looking, for example, at some of the most grotesque examples, that like in the KKK. So when the KKK shows up and you've got a cross, I think in my uninformed way, what I wanted to say was, oh, no, they're just abusing. They're trying to co-opt religious symbols to propagate their racism. But what I hear you saying is that, no, that's a completely insufficient understanding of what's going on there. That instead, what's going on is that by the time you get to the KKK, 450 years of Christian history has been cultivating this sort of way of looking at the world, grounded in a notion of Christian notions of providence. It's a very long, deeply wed, problematic imagination.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is why for so many people, if we look at the actual trajectory, the historical trajectory that America is formed inside of, then the truth of the matter is if we want to be true to that trajectory, then the KKK, white supremacists, they are actually true to the trajectory. And that's the painful thing for so many people.
It is.
To get their minds around. The idea that I have come to take this land and to build a world by building my wealth, by building my voice, by building myself from ownership of this land.
And commodification of black bodies.
Right. Is fundamental to the West. This is why, you know, I always say anybody who wants to try to address race and refuses to look at the way private property functions will never address race. These things are bound together. The control of my space is the control of my body. And if you remember that saying, and you think about what white supremacists are saying, you think about what people who we would say are on the far right, what they actually say, what you will hear inside whatever they say is exactly what I just said. The control of my body is the control of my space, and the control of my space is the control of my body. That runs all the way from how they understand the nation itself, to their neighborhoods, to their own physical well-being. For us to challenge it, we have to first recognize, you know, this is our baby. This is the child we brought into the world. And now that it's full grown and has weapons, we've got to walk up to our child and say, hold on. Let me explain to you why you are wrong, because we created you, but this is not right.
We'll be back with this special Juneteenth edition of Main Street right after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
Whether you're a sustaining member, or you give annually, or you've made additional contributions to Prairie Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Prairie Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today we are airing a special edition of Main Street from the acclaimed No Small Endeavor podcast with its host, Lee C. Camp. We now resume the second half of today's show.
Welcome back to No Small Endeavor, exploring what it means to live a good life. I'm Lee C. Camp. If you're just joining us, we've already heard from one prominent figure in the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, Dr. Fred Gray, who was first attorney for Ms. Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Then we heard from Yale professor Willie James Jennings on the origins of race. We turn now to another moral exemplar in the fight for equity and justice.
By 1952, I was convinced out of my Gandhi studies that we black folk could have a massive movement of nonviolence that would shake and change the nation.
That's James Lawson. He's considered by many as the architect of the nonviolence of the civil rights movement in the United States. As a young man, he became convinced that his Christian faith required him to practice nonviolence. He was subsequently imprisoned as a consequence of refusing to submit to the military draft for the Korean War. And then, after his release, he went to India as a missionary with the Methodist Church. There, he encountered Gandhi's history-changing employment of nonviolent resistance on a societal level. Witnessing its power firsthand, he returned to the U.S., determined to employ these tactics. He became a mentor to prominent figures like John Lewis, teaching students the principles of nonviolence and preparing them for the challenges they would face in the fight for racial equality, like the desegregation of lunch counters via so-called sit-ins. In time, you're invited to come to the South to begin working in the movement there?
My going to Nashville was not because I was recruited. It was because I had committed myself to, as soon as possible, get into the South to work with Martin King and the movement. But my first big operation as Southern Secretary was in Little Rock. My first day in Little Rock, I meet all nine of the Little Rock students. I ask them right off, what is going on? They said, the lawyers and the NAACP and our parents tell us we may not fight back. And there is some anger in me that happens, that's what's going on. And I then eat all my anger up inside, and I say to them, what they actually mean is, you are not to fight back like you are being attacked. You are not to hate as your enemies in the school and the governor hate you. I said, you are to fight back with character.
So when you began to send out groups of students to do the sit-in, I wondered what sorts of levels of anxiety are you dealing with personally as you are watching these young people that you've trained go out into these hostile situations?
I think the major anxiety they had was, will it work? Mm. They knew about the possibility they would be hit, could get hurt. One of the big gains of the nation was we showed the nation that democracy can make changes without firing a shot, without killing anybody, without beating up on anybody. Because the great task from Nashville is that we started the public desegregation of the nation. And we did it without hating anybody.
Yeah. Yes.
We bombed no store. We killed no police officer. We chased no white boy down the street.
In 1968, Lawson was in the middle of the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis, which demanded safety measures, better wages, new benefits, and a recognition of their labor union. Finally, the labor committee in the city of Memphis agreed to write a letter of recognition of the union, but the mayor refused to approve the move. And at City Hall, things began to grow tense.
The 700 or 800 or 1,000 men with their families, in some cases, begin to shout and yell, scream. We manage to get order in from the stage. I call Frank Holloman, who is the new ex-FBI man who is the commissioner of fire and police, and say to him, we're going to peacefully walk down the main street to Mason Temple for a community meeting with the union. He agrees. And the net result is then we bring 800 or so public works employees out on the intersection and proceed to line them up to march to Mason Temple. I am in front of one of the major department stores. The march is going well. It is peaceful. Police cars roll out of the side streets. Each car has four white officers in it. They drive up right next to the march. About five or six police cars back, that car is apparently designated to be the antagonist, because that car keeps turning in on the workers. Before we know it, that car has done its job. Workers put their hands in the car. The white officers pour out of the cars instantly with cans of mace, and they mace us all. Some people, like myself, got more macing than others, but some workers got it. Some preachers got it. I had glasses on, so my macing was not as bad as they hoped, although I got it in my ears and a little rolled into my eyes. But otherwise, I did not lose the use of my eyes. And as that happened, I shouted out, let us go to Mason Temple anyway, and we'll still have our meeting. And word got out, and as we arrived there, I walked the whole distance with the escort of police officers, one of whom walked right in front of me and kept, or on the side of me, and kept trying to show how mad he was at me. He didn't strike me, but he kept looking at me as though he wanted to do it. And so there at Mason Temple, we reunited, and people were pouring in from all over the city. The group decided, number one, the community was going to back the strike fully. They named several of us to a strategy committee. That's what happened then. Later on, Harold Middlebrooks, one of our fine pastors just outside the city, called me to say that the meeting told me to call you and tell you that you're to call the meeting together and make the plans and do the work. So that's how that organized.
In time, Reverend Lawson called Dr. King and asked him to come to Memphis. He arrived April 3, 1968. That afternoon brought a thunderstorm, a Memphis deluge, so great that Dr. King considered not going to the Bishop Charles Mason Temple, where the mass meeting was scheduled, thinking no one would be there. Upon realizing that hundreds, thousands had already arrived, he made his way to the venue. In his speech that night, which some have described as especially emotional, he recounted his life and labors in the movement, how grateful he was for the work he'd been given to do. Near the end of the speech, he told of the occasion he had been stabbed and nearly died. The tip of the knife came so close to his aorta that the New York Times reported that if he had merely sneezed, he would have died. And he told how a young girl, a ninth grade student, a little white girl, wrote him a letter to tell him that she was just so happy that he did not sneeze. And how happy he was, too, that he had not sneezed, for it would have kept him from seeing the wonders in Nashville, Birmingham, Albany, Selma, Washington, D.C., and he wouldn't have been there that night in Memphis. And then he closed, referring to the rumors and threats that were out and about, and that he didn't really care because, he said, I've been to the mountaintop. He wouldn't mind living a long life, he said, but he knew he might not get that, and he just wanted to do God's will. And he said that he was not afraid, not fearing any man, that his eyes had seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Less than 24 hours later, Dr. King was assassinated, standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel there in Memphis. When you think back to Dr. King's assassination there in Memphis, what are memories that stand out for you in that 24-hour period?
April the 4th, 1968. I have to tell you that my friend Martin and I were very much like each other. We had read the same books at Morehouse, Baldwin Wallace, and Boston. We had some of the same people teach us at Boston when I finished up at Boston. We were third-generation pastors. Martin and I simply clicked. And part of the reason we clicked is that by 1952, I knew we were going to have a movement. I did not know who was going to emerge, but I saw as whoever was going to emerge was going to be my Moses, and that's the word I used to myself in India and before and after. So I'm doing a memoir. I do not know how many times King and I conferred by phone. I do not know how many times King and I took walks at Penn Center or in Georgia, at our staff retreats, our board retreats, when he and I would take walks for the purpose of talking. And his, in large measure, sharing with me where he thought things were and wanting me to bounce against it so that he could feel that he was moving in the right direction. I can't tell you how often that happened.
Yeah.
When the sanitation strike began, and I canceled going to see him in Miami, where he had called and wanted me to do some nonviolent lectures for preachers he had brought in to try to help them understand nonviolent struggle. I canceled and told him that we're going to run the strike like a nonviolent movement, and that he would be getting word from me because I would want him to come into a mass meeting. We were in court April the 4th. So I was somewhat upset because I had to be a witness in the case against SCLC being in Memphis that morning. And Martin insisted that Andrew Young and I, who would be the witnesses in the federal court, would come by before we went to court. And we talked in that morning. And when I asked for the court to let me go, it was after lunch, around 2 o'clock or so. I then went back to where King was at the motel and visited with him about the movement until maybe 5 o'clock, and then went to the strike office to see what things I had to do for the next steps, then landed at home around 6 o'clock because Dorothy and I had a discipline that I would always be home at 6 o'clock no matter what was going on. I would be home and we would have supper on the table with, by that time, three sons. And so a little before 6, I was walking into the kitchen greeting her, and then heard from an alcove the TV interrupted by announcement that King had been shot. So that tells you my history, a piece of it that day. But I spent probably close to 4 hours with King at the motel before the court opened, and then spent probably close to the same amount of time or more with King after I left court.
During our afternoon together, Reverend Lawson and I talked about many more of his experiences helping to lead the civil rights movement. You can hear the entire unabridged interview on our podcast. But to close, I asked Reverend Lawson, an ordained Methodist, what practices had sustained him in his own pursuit of a good life. As we get close to finishing up, I wonder if you could share a little bit about what sorts of disciplines, to use a word you used earlier, have continued to help you stay the course. What is it for you that has kind of helped you try to practice a vision of life that you have felt called to ever since you were that four-year-old?
Well, the scriptures have been my primary book for the inward life. And Jesus of Nazareth has been my primary figure. And the Exodus, the first written account we have of civil disobedience, the first written account that we have of what was probably a essentially nonviolent movement of the escape of slaves from Egypt to the Promised Land, are two of the several places that I know about that have informed me over the years. And then, of course, my primary mantra is still follow Jesus. And in my reflection and prayers and Bible reading and practice of this presence that goes on now, there is a centrality to the role of the Spirit of Jesus as the highest possible form of religion that the human race knows anything about. And then there is a quiet in-house confidence in the work I have done. What people who call me a civil rights worker do not know is that I, at a very early age, knew I was to be a pastor. As early as junior high school, the seventh grade, I realized I was on my way towards being a pastor. In high school, I was convinced I would be a pastor. So it's as a pastor I have worked. And many people are not aware of the fact that I pastored three congregations, and they give me today quiet joy in how I was able to live, what I was able to do, how I was able to participate in the lives of all kinds of people from that position of a pastor.
We've been talking to Reverend James Lawson here at Holman United Methodist Church, which he served for many years in the parlor. And Reverend Lawson, we thank you for your generosity with your time, and we thank you for the beautiful example of your life and for your sharing with us today.
Thank you very much for wanting to do this, and I'm pleased I'm able to do it.
Thank you. Reverend Lawson just passed away this past week at the age of 95. You've been listening to No Small Endeavor and our special episode in preparation for Juneteenth, featuring civil rights attorney Fred Gray, Yale professor Willie James Jennings, and the architect of the nonviolence of the civil rights movement, Reverend James Lawson. Did you know that we continue exploring what it means to live a good life in our conversation for our episodes on NSC Plus? Well, if not, we do. And there, once a month, I, along with our executive producer, Jacob Lewis, experiment on ourselves, you might say, with what Jacob calls a little practice in a big practice. Then we share what we experience, sharing what we learn along the way. This month, we consider practices of nonviolent resistance in light of the lives of Dr. Fred Gray and Reverend James Lawson. If you'd like to hear about what we learned from experimenting with those practices and how they might help you, you can hear more on our latest bonus episode on NSC Plus. If you missed a portion of this interview or would like to have access to the complete unabridged versions of our interviews with Fred Gray, Willie James Jennings, or James Lawson, you can follow our podcast wherever you listen. We gratefully acknowledge the support of Lilly Endowment Incorporated, a private philanthropic foundation supporting the causes of community development, education, and religion, and the support of the John Templeton Foundation, whose vision is to become a global catalyst for discoveries that contribute to human flourishing. Our thanks to all the stellar team that makes this show possible. Christy Bragg, Jacob Lewis, Sophie Byard, Tom Anderson, Kate Hayes, Mary Evelyn Brown, Carriot Harmon, Jason Cheesley, Ellis Osborne, and Tim Lauer. Thanks for listening, and let's keep exploring what it means to live a good life together. No Small Endeavor is a production of PRX, Tokens Media, LLC, and
Great Feeling Studios. Oh.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 19th. At the end of the Civil War, the country began waking up to the realities of recovery. Railroads and bridges had been destroyed. Farms had been wiped out. Disabled veterans were unable to support themselves, and widows and orphans had been left behind. President Lincoln had promised to care for those who have borne the burden, his widow and orphans. But no one knew how to go about doing that. Veterans took the matter into their own hands. The Grand Army of the Republic was founded in 1866. Membership was open to anyone honorably discharged from the Union Army. By 1890, there were over 400,000 members. The organization lobbied Congress to establish pensions for veterans and actively supported political candidates who would enact laws favorable to veterans. On this date, in 1905, the annual encampment of the North Dakota GAR concluded their gathering in Jamestown. The meeting was a great success, with over 50% of the state membership in attendance. The Women's Relief Corps held their annual meeting in conjunction with the encampment. Women who supported the veterans had formed their relief corps to assist the GAR in its work. Women had provided support during the war, and they continued to serve in that role. The GAR granted the relief corps the right to use the title Auxiliary to the Grand Army of the Republic. The women appreciated the warm reception they received in Jamestown, but focused more on their work than on sightseeing and social activities. They elected officers for the coming year and made plans for their activities in support of the GAR. The two organizations held a joint session. As the veterans aged, they knew they needed the support of allied organizations. The GAR extended warmest thanks to the loyal women of the land for their earnest support and encouragement. They called the women of the Relief Corps our one great hope. Even though the last Civil War veteran has long since passed away, the Women's Relief Corps continues to be active. The organization funds scholarships, supports child welfare programs, and provides outreach to veterans in hospitals and nursing homes. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Thank you for joining us today on Main Street. Tomorrow on the show, our news director, Dave Thompson, will review this week's news, and our movie critic, Matt O'Lean, reviews the movie I Saw the TV Glow. We hope you can join us again tomorrow on Main Street.